KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Over $42 million will be distributed to Doña Ana County under the American Rescue Plan Act. Madison Staten reports on the county's proposed spending plan.
Doña Ana County commissioners are currently reviewing the best way to allocate millions in American Rescue Act funding. The county, which was allotted over $42 million, has identified four areas of focus: longstanding public health issues, negative economic impacts, premium pay for essential county workers, and critical infrastructure investments. Part of the proposed plan includes funding for a new Office of Emergency Management facility. The current building is 5,000 square feet, which the county says has led to operating challenges. County Manager Fernando Macias says funding for the new 16,000-square-foot building could come from both the American Rescue Act and FEMA.
The intent is to ultimately have a standalone building that is dedicated to the Office of Emergency Management, and that represents and contains space in order to do the full coordination involving all of the local governments in Doña Ana County. We would be looking to FEMA, hopefully, to at least provide 50% of the funding related to the building.
$1.5 million is being proposed to support small businesses. Already, the county has used over $3 million in additional funding to help local businesses through the pandemic. But Davin Lopez from the Mesilla Valley Economic Development Alliance says he sees how more funding could be needed to adequately address the hardship.
We're seeing industry now coming back, sometimes even stronger, and new opportunities are out there. And in that respect, I could see where there's some needed funding to help that momentum continue forward.
The plan also seeks to qualify all county workers as essential, while entitling them to premium pay, an amount of $4,000 to be distributed over the next year. It's an endeavor estimated to cost over $3 million. Commissioner Lynn Ellens says that while he will vote to approve the increased pay, he does not believe all county workers should be able to qualify as essential.
I don't see how we could classify all county employees as essential workers under the definition of what an essential worker is. I'm not opposed to the $4,000, but I do have big problems classifying everybody as essential.
County Manager Fernando Macias emphasized the reclassification is within county rights under federal guidelines.
We wouldn't be putting this forward unless the guidelines themselves from the federal government has basically already indicated that any employee can be deemed an essential employee. So if we adopted this strategy, we would not be having to justify that some employees are in a different category than others.
More than $10 million is being proposed for critical infrastructure investments, including the completion of a broadband feasibility study, as well as a flood mitigation project. County Flood Commission Director John Gwynn spoke about why flood control investment is in the public's best interest.
Brahmin Channel and Dragonfly Channel project is a massive project that impacts probably the largest population area within the county. It's the backbone to any flood control that happens on East Mesa. All the water that's through any other project on East Mesa has to flow through this channel. So it becomes the main push for what has to get done.
Above all, County Manager Fernando Macias stressed the need for expedient decision-making.
The sooner we start and the sooner we know what the priorities are that have been endorsed by the commission, the sooner we're beginning these projects.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
The Doña Ana County Commission is currently scheduled to vote on American Rescue Plan Act funding recommendations at its June 22nd meeting. Policies restricting access to comprehensive reproductive health care are costly to women and states' economies. That's according to a new study by the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Roz Brown has more from the Texas News Service.
The group has launched a new tool to assess the financial impacts of state-level reproductive health restrictions. Alexis McGill-Johnson with the Planned Parenthood Federation of America says restricting access to comprehensive reproductive health care not only costs individual women wages, but can be expensive for state economies.
We know at the national level, the state level abortion restrictions cost $105 billion per year by reducing labor force participation and earnings.
Data from the new online tool shows that if all state level abortion restrictions were eliminated, more than 500,000 women would enter the workforce. The estimated earnings increase for working women in Texas would be more than $14 billion. I'm Roz Brown.
Nearly a third of low-income immigrant families with children say someone in their family avoided public benefits because of immigration-related concerns. That's as needs for benefits increased during the COVID-19 pandemic. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval has our report.
The Urban Institute think tank found immigrant families most often avoided SNAP or food benefits, Medicaid, and CHIP health care for kids. Jennifer Haley authored the report and says this is despite significant financial hardships like struggling to pay rent, utilities, or food.
We found that many immigrant families with children did report needs. And almost half reported that the pandemic had affected their family's finances. Either someone in the family lost work or lost income because of the pandemic.
The report attributes some of the hesitancy to receive benefits to a Trump-era policy that made it harder for low-income immigrants to get green cards because of their likelihood to depend on certain public benefits. Biden and court challenges effectively ended that policy, though Texas and 13 other states are trying to bring it back and earlier this year filed paperwork with the Supreme Court to defend it. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
Vice President Kamala Harris was in Mexico this week, the focus of her trip, the root causes of migration. In recent years, most people trying to reach the U.S. have set off from Central America, and the children, teens, and families cut through Mexico. 2 years ago this month, Mexico's president deployed the National Guard to the border. KTEP's Angela Cocherga examines the impact.
The figures in pale camouflage uniforms are posted along the border from the fence jutting high above the desert on the outskirts of El Paso to the muddy banks of the Rio Grande near downtown Juarez. These are strategic points, says a Mexican National Guard member in Juarez who did not want his name used because he's not authorized to do interviews. He and a partner stood in the shade of a small tree to escape the blazing sun, long guns slung over their shoulders. He says the flow of migrants is reduced because of their presence as a neighborhood dog napping nearby woke up and started barking. Mexico's National Guard arrived in Juarez 2 years ago this month. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador deployed more than 25,000 troops to both of the country's borders in the summer of 2019. At that time, President Donald Trump was threatening to impose high tariffs on all Mexican goods as his administration struggled with the surge in migration from Central America.
You know, it's legitimate for countries to control their borders, and the National Guard has legal authority to participate in this.
Andrew Seeley is president of the Washington, D.C.-based Migration Policy Institute. Mexico's National Guard has both been touted as effective for border enforcement and criticized for not being trained for civilian duty. 2 years later, there are lingering questions about the Guard's mission, says Seeley.
You know, it's a force that was created primarily to deal with organized crime and to deal with criminal elements in society and heavily armed groups. If the intention is to keep the National Guard involved with migration issues, there needs to be an effort to create a part of the National Guard that is specifically trained to work with civilian populations.
There was a sharp decline in border crossings after Mexico's National Guard arrived at the border in 2019. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, apprehensions fell from more than 144,000 in May of that year to about 81,000 in July, the first full month Mexico's National Guard was on the border. During the current spike in migration, the López Obrador administration has agreed to keep about 10,000 troops on the border. Marisa Limón is deputy director of the nonprofit Hope Border Institute.
They have a bargaining chip. it's just unfortunate that it's come to the militarization, the militarized response, the National Guard, and to the policing of migrants and making things more difficult as a way for political gain.
Human rights concerns and allegations of excessive force persist in parts of Mexico. A soldier shot and killed a Guatemalan man in a car at a border checkpoint in the southern state Chiapas in March. And last September, troops fired on a car, killing a woman and injuring her husband in the northern border state, Chihuahua. On the border in Juarez, the guardsmen say their role is about more than enforcement. They also help migrants in distress who are injured or ill. The guardsman says migrants put their lives at risk with the sun, snakes, scorpions. But they try, he says, because many believe in the American dream. Half a dozen Central American women, most with children, interviewed one afternoon a few weeks ago, said they are not deterred by Mexico's National Guard and would find a way to cross the border. A 38-year-old mother from Honduras who does not want her name used says, National Guard or not,
yo voy a llegar allá. Primero, Dios.
She'll reach the U.S., God willing. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
More border coverage now, and adult use cannabis becomes legal in New Mexico at the end of the month. Just across the border in Mexico, that country recently appeared poised to become the biggest in the world to fully legalize marijuana. But as KUT's Antonio Cueto reports, it hasn't happened yet.
This began 3 years ago, when Mexico's Supreme Court ruled that previous law banning the recreational use of marijuana was unconstitutional. But while the lower chamber of Congress signed a legalization bill that also enjoys the support of Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador and Morena, the ruling party, the measure to turn the country into the world's biggest legal marijuana market seems stuck.
The Senate did not comply with the deadline set by the Supreme Court. So they didn't ask for an extension, which is what they have done three times previously. They might possibly request or have an extraordinary legislative session.
Sarah Snap is from the Instituto RIA, an organization focused on drug policy reform. But even though she supports legalization, she's not in favor of the current bill.
Unfortunately, repairing the harms of prohibition and affirmative actions towards communities was much more present in previous versions of the bill.
SNAP says the original bill promised to prioritize the creation of a local market controlled by indigenous communities and small producers.
There was also, for example, restrictions on the number of dispensaries that a single business could own. We see this as positive because we don't want it to be the same business on every single corner selling.
SNAP says the current version of the bill favors bigger industry players.
If we don't take those steps, then this could turn into just another extractive industry where large companies come to Mexico to, in quotations, invest in Mexico. But really, it just means they would be taking advantage of cheap labor.
And instead of creating a new department to regulate the chain of production, distribution, and consumption, as it was first proposed by the Senate, the current version leaves it up to the National Commission Against Drug Addiction, which, she says, is not prepared to do this. Another concern that SNAP has is that the bill doesn't really do much to change how law enforcement interacts with cannabis users. The bill, as it is now, limits adults aged 18 and over to 28 grams. That's less than half a pound. Carrying more could mean an equivalent of a $500 fine, or 6 years in prison if it exceeds 200 grams, or 7 ounces. Those who register for a license could grow 6 plants, but growing more could mean up to 10 years in jail. Back at the Senate building, leaders from different pro-weed collectives, like Pablo Alfa Herrera from Asamblea Canábica Más Conciencia Menos TV, give fiery speeches that echo some of SNAP's criticisms.
Por otro lado, el umbral de 28 gramos que se propone en esa regulación, pues solo eleva.
Alfa says the proposed legislation isn't honoring the Supreme Court's mandate. They declared that we are free, he says. That it's not a crime anymore to smoke weed or carry it. Mexico's Congress was supposed to pass a law by now. But again, that hasn't happened yet.
No queremos un registro de usuarias y usuarios.
Alfa also worries that the proposed licensing process will give police a way to harass users. He says activists don't want a database of users that they don't know where it'll end up, or if it's going to be used against them. Mario González Frangiuti agrees. He's a retired litigation lawyer who now lives in Querétaro, where he grows fruit trees, vegetable crops, and also weed for himself.
Mi intención nunca va a ser pedir autorización.
González grows 6 to 8 plants a year, which would be the limit under the law, just enough for himself and to give some to friends and family. However, he doesn't intend on asking for permission. He says he'll just continue growing the way he's been doing so far, because he's worried authorities will use a registration system to extort him.
Es solamente prestarse o darle facultades a los supervisores a extorsionarnos.
But, though there are problems with the current proposals, many, including Sarah Snap with the Instituto RIA, are especially frustrated with the legal limbo.
We know that there are improvements to the bill that must be made. However, we also have been in this process for quite a long time, and we'd like to move to the next scenario, because every day that we wait is another day where people are being persecuted, detained, prosecuted, and where communities are being marginalized and oftentimes displaced.
If the Senate's special session fails and another extension is required, SNAP says another way to legalize weed could be another Supreme Court decision. I'm Antonio Cueto in Mexico City.
New research looking at data from millions of Texas police stops in 2020 found that officers are more likely to search Latinos than any other race or ethnic group. But those searches turn up far less contraband than searches of whites. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports.
The research was done by the Institute for Predictive Analytics in Criminal Justice at Tarleton State University. Alex Del Carmen is a criminologist who heads the institute, and he's an expert on racial profiling.
So here you have a scenario where whites are being stopped the most, Hispanics are being searched the most, but whites are the ones where contraband is being found the most.
That discrepancy means a lot more innocent Latinos are being subjected to searches than white people are, which can damage trust in police. Del Carmen says the data may be an indication that bias is driving officers to search Latinos more often than whites.
We have no way of getting into the officer's brain and figuring out what the intention of that officer was, whether the officer intended to make a legitimate stop, or the officer is making a stop as a result of some racist factor, right? But what we kind of all agree with across the United States is that the end result of the search is very telling.
There are some limitations to the research. Only about 80% of departments reported data on police stops that was granular enough to see these trends. Next year, all departments will be required to report this data. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. If you ever miss the program, a reminder, it's always online for you in the local radio section at krwg.org. And if you like to listen to audio on your mobile phone or other mobile device, why not download the NPR One app? You'll find KRWG News This Week. Lots of other great local content and the best national and world coverage from NPR. That's the NPR One app. We're connected to it. And of course, we're always connected with you at krwg.org. Well, I want to move now to some other big local political news. The Las Cruces City Council is limiting where legal fireworks can be used following a declaration of extreme drought. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
An extreme drought has been declared by the Las Cruces City Council, limiting the locations legal fireworks will be allowed within the city for the next 30 days. The resolution, unanimously passed by the council, will restrict the use of legal fireworks like flitter sparklers and crackling devices to completely barren land or areas that have readily accessible sources of water. Aerial fireworks remain illegal under state law. Las Cruces Fire Marshal Cody Hafer says he looks forward to resuming more normal 4th of July celebrations this year, but emphasized protecting the Las Cruces community remains his number one priority. He noted the resolution has no bearing on the City of Las Cruces, New Mexico State University firework display.
I think it is absolutely wonderful that we were able to celebrate the 4th of July more this year than maybe we did last year. But, you know, please be safe about it. Drought is a real thing here in our area. Brush fires and structure fires happen very easily. And so we don't want to put that extra stress on our emergency responders to have to deal with those things as well as our normal call volume.
The U.S. Drought Monitor reports the most intense period of drought since the creation of the monitoring system occurred in mid-January of this year and impacted over 54% of the state. For Hafer, the drier landscape means increased safety precautions must be taken.
Almost all of New Mexico is under moderate to exceptional drought this year. We are in an extreme drought condition and have been for quite a while. And what that means is that according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, many things are occurring. Native vegetation is dying. Creeks and riverbeds are nearly dry or almost dry. Soil moisture is very low. Humidity is very low.
Counselor Tessa Abeda-Stuvey pointed to fire devastation she witnessed growing up as one reason the City of Las Cruces must work to protect the community.
I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, which is no stranger to fires, and really truly seeing the devastation that can happen when you have an uncontrolled burn, and it can start in numerous different ways. And I'll tell you, from the smoke, smelling it, seeing your house burn down and having just a go bag for 3 days, it leaves an impact. And that was for over 285 homes of residential. And that can be really devastating for our community.
Preventing that devastation is a priority for Counselor Joanna Bencomo, who talked about the recent loss of smoke jumper Tim Hart. Hart died this month from injuries fighting a wildfire in southwestern New Mexico.
My condolences go to his family and his loved ones and his team. I hope that the public understands, right, the risk that we put our fire crews in if we don't take these kinds of measures.
Counselor Gabe Vasquez says responsible firework use, coupled with strong enforcement, will be the key to ensuring a safe summer.
I know it's always a tall task each year because there are just so many fireworks that get brought in from different communities and across state lines, across county lines, that kind of thing. So I know that that gets tough. And then, yes, we are in potentially one of the worst fire years that I have seen.
The ban, which remains in place through the beginning of July, will include the 4th of July weekend. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And a reminder, we can't emphasize it enough, even when there isn't a drought. In the state of New Mexico, you cannot use fireworks that shoot up into the air. Not for personal use. Of course, fireworks shows do this, but you can't do that. It is illegal. It doesn't make sense to some people because those fireworks are sold in New Mexico. But as we know, the law doesn't always make sense. So you might be able to buy some fireworks in New Mexico that are actually illegal to shoot off here. Keep that in mind. Don't want a visit from the police around July 4th. Well, we move to commentary now. Should a former president be subject to incarceration if convicted of a crime? Some thoughts from Peter Goodman.
Some folks think that even if prosecutors prove Donald Trump committed huge crimes, we should never see a U.S. president in an orange jumpsuit. If Trump cheated banks and governments, they can sue him, a civil case. I say, treat him as you'd treat John Doe on the same facts. Don't indict Trump vengefully or because of his politics. If he's a danger to our republic, we should fight that danger in appropriate ways. Twisting our legal system to jail Trump won't protect our system, but weaken it. Trump should not have tried to use the Justice Department to attack political enemies. Neither should we. Trump allegedly committed massive fraud and violations of tax laws. There's evidence he used various schemes to compensate employees under the table to avoid taxes. Allegedly, assets were significantly undervalued to the tax person or greatly inflated to lenders. If convicted, Trump should be treated as others who've committed similar crimes involving similar amounts. No excessive punishment, but no slap on the wrist where we'd jail somebody else. It's a key tenet of our democracy that no one is above the law. No one. Our founders would have loathed the thought of immunizing high officials against criminal prosecution. Yes, in practice, powerful people abuse their power and escape punishment for misconduct, or their crimes are ignored by lesser officials to curry favor. Some say the whole system is corrupt, and all presidents have probably committed crimes. Richard Nixon seems to have committed crimes, including obstruction of justice and aiding and abetting burglary, but Gerald Ford pardoned him. Bill Clinton committed perjury, but in criminal law, the exculpatory lie, just wrongfully saying, "I didn't do it," is rarely prosecuted. Warren Harding appointed a cabinet full of poker pals and other cronies, some flagrantly dishonest, and some went to jail. But Harding, who apparently wasn't personally involved in crimes, was pardoned by death. I think LBJ and Nixon committed war crimes in Southeast Asia. Bush, too, winked at illegal torture, and Obama's pursuit of terrorists probably violated international law. But where the alleged crime is committed in the public's interest, we may have to grant some leeway, although just how much should be a damn tough question. We don't give a get-out-of-jail-free card to a criminal who gets himself elected president. If we did, how would a judge sentence a shoplifter from Walmart when the president skates after stealing millions? Too many public officials already get away with too much misconduct. Orange hair wearing orange might be good for our country, but that's a thought I'd put aside if I were a juror. Trump deserves the same treatment you or I would get for the same conduct.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. When the pandemic-related federal eviction moratorium expires on June 30th, renters will need to provide a written statement to their landlord to receive additional protections. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown report.
The Biden administration has promised billions more aid through the Emergency Rental Assistance Allocation, but the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says tenants need to initiate the process. Bree Sillery with the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness says a renter must have a declaratory statement in writing to show they're unable to pay rent because of the pandemic.
Everyone is really agreeing we need to get this money to the people that are needing it and making sure that we are eliminating barriers such as uncooperative property management companies.
I'm Roz Brown.
More housing news now. This is really interesting. According to data from the National Low Income Housing Coalition, 25% of New Mexico renters, 1 in 4, are extremely low income. The group says the state lacks affordable housing for those living below the poverty line. During the pandemic, as we've been telling you, eviction protections have helped keep many renters in their homes. But what are state lawmakers doing to address affordable housing in the state? Anthony Moreno recently talked with Democratic State Representative Angelica Rubio of Las Cruces, who has been working to address this issue.
State Representative Angelica Rubio, thank you so much for joining us. I want to talk with you about housing. The Albuquerque Journal North's editorial board wrote last month that the city of Santa Fe could see nearly 6,000 evictions once government protections for renters ends. Now, housing protections is an issue that you've worked on in our state. I'd like to hear your concerns about housing right now at this point in the pandemic.
So thanks, Anthony. I mean, it's certainly a big important issue for me. New Mexico is already in a housing crisis prior to the global pandemic. And so right now, we're just trying to really deal with some of that. House Bill 111, which is a legislation that both myself and Representative Romero introduced, would have increased rental protections, not only during emergencies, but also beyond that, because we felt that there was a lot of patterns and trends that were occurring that we wanted to try to fix. We unfortunately were not able to get that legislation through this past session, even after a number of hearings. And so we're currently working on what we can potentially do in the next session next year. It is a 30-day session, which means the governor would have to put it on her agenda. And so that is our goal over the course of the next few months.
Okay, now you mentioned that there were some issues that were catching your attention before the pandemic. What were those?
We felt like we needed to extend the time permitted to for tenants to pay their unpaid rent because the time limit was really too short. It was, I believe, at 3 days. We were wanting to extend that. We wanted to also require longer time periods to be given for non-payment notices, as well as prohibiting retaliation against the tenant who reports problems related to like their owner provided services or appliances.
During this pandemic, we've heard about the Zoom boom. Different states and cities have been looking at ways to lure people who are working remotely to their communities, folks who are making a higher income so that they can bring those dollars to their communities. What are your thoughts on this so-called Zoom boom and how that could possibly impact some low-income renters in New Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think it's sort of like twofold. I know that New Mexico, because we're constantly searching for ways to bring in a new tax base, I can see how many folks in our communities, leaders who would see this as important, especially because of our weather and outdoor recreation and that economy. But I fear that the sort of this born-again remote workers seeking these desirable areas like Las Cruces is actually going to really hinder. And we already have issues with finding affordable housing. And so what I would suggest is that if we're going to be attracting these types of workers, that we, because we're giving up all these large office spaces for remote work here locally, that what is the city looking to do to convert some of these facilities to affordable housing is, I think, sort of that balance that we need to start looking at. We could certainly be addressing this as a both and, that if we're attracting, then what are we also doing to make sure that we have affordable housing for those that actually already live here?
Due to the pandemic, construction materials are really expensive right now. So how do you think that cities or communities in our state can address this issue and invest in affordable housing with the materials being so expensive?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, we're seeing it in a lot of different areas outside of even just construction. I think it's just part of just better planning. I know that other parts of the country, parts of the world, have really made some significant updates to just some of their urban planning and city planning. And I think that's just something that the city and the county and the rest of the state is really going to have to look at. And then having the state address it, especially in the next budget year, and see how we can be supportive of that.
State Representative Angelica Rubio, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And to stay up to date with legislative activities in New Mexico, you can check out the New Mexico Legislature section. It's under the News tab at krwg.org. An increase in people visiting public lands during the pandemic led to gridlock in some locations, according to the U.S. Forest Service. More as we check in again with the New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown.
At the height of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020, Americans hit the road, with the U.S. Forest Service reporting an increase of 19 million visitors last summer over 2019 numbers. Maureen Brooks is a wildfire prevention officer with the Forest Service and expects an equal number of people will want to get out and enjoy public lands this year. She says a list of tips has been created for those planning summer vacations in the forest.
It's important for folks this year as they're planning their summer vacations to plan ahead. Know before you go is something we like to mention to people. Have some alternative plans should there be some closures or restrictions.
Brooke says recommended tips and resources for a safe summer experience can be found at beoutdoorsafe.org. In 2020, the western United States experienced a series of major wildfires, and Brooks is especially concerned that visitors to public lands practice fire safety. Due to severe drought, New Mexico's first major wildfire this year ignited in April near a campground where visitors hiked to view prehistoric petroglyphs. Brooks reminds visitors to the outdoors that 9 out of 10 wildfires are typically preventable.
In our country, nationwide, about 87% of wildfires are human caused, from different things like campfires, debris burning, and that sort of thing.
Brooks says campers should investigate the best time to visit their favorite public parks and trails, check for camping and fire restrictions, and have the proper equipment to extinguish a campfire. She also reminds those hauling campers or trailers to make sure they're properly attached and not creating sparks that could start a fire. For New Mexico News Connection, I'm Roz Brown.
Okay, a real treat for you now. It's an exclusive to KRWG News this week. It's a little too long for our newscast during the week, but it's well worth the time. 50 years ago, the first presidential library to call the Lone Star State home opened its doors on the UT Austin campus. The library and museum commemorates one of the most turbulent, consequential presidencies of the 20th century, that of Lyndon Baines Johnson. And as the Texas Standard's Shelley Brisbane reports, the dedication of the LBJ Library marked both a coming together and an example of the divisions that the 1960s revealed in American society.
On a bright May day, former President Lyndon Johnson walked with Richard Nixon, his successor, to a platform just south of the new building that bore Johnson's name. And they weren't the only bold-faced names gathered there.
President Nixon and President Johnson, and then President Johnson's cabinet was there, along with Governor John Conley was there, Dr. Billy Graham was there.
And so was Ben Barnes, at the time Texas Lieutenant Governor and now Vice Chair of the LBJ Foundation. Nixon spoke first. He accepted the new LBJ Library on behalf of the American people. Then Johnson rose to acknowledge his achievement, the massive 10-story structure that then held 31 million pages of archives. 45 million pages are stored there now. In the distance, some 2,000 protesters, according to the New York Times, chanted and banged trash can lids. The Vietnam War, which had escalated dramatically during Johnson's time in office, was still raging, and in May 1971, many were in no mood to celebrate his legacy. But on the grounds of the new LBJ Presidential Library, a cross-section of American political leaders paid tribute, including Barry Goldwater, the man Johnson had defeated in 1964. On the platform, Johnson cut a striking figure.
We all had on dark suits, but President Johnson that day, I always remember, wore a tan cotton suit, but he stood out on the platform because he was the only person in that light-colored suit.
Johnson's remarks were brief. He offered a vision for the ways in which the library would educate and inform future generations, and he made a commitment to openness and transparency. History with the bark off, he called it, as the sounds of protest remained audible in the distance.
There is no record of a mistake, or an unpleasantness, or criticism that is not included in the files here. We have papers from 40 some very turbulent years of public service, and we put them all over here in one place for friends and foes to judge.
Indeed, the library has provided some of the most remarkable historical artifacts of any presidency. Hours of recordings Johnson made of his Oval Office telephone conversations. The tapes feature Johnson cajoling, bullying, and sharing confidences with everyone from uncooperative senators to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In August 1965, King warned Johnson that police violence and hopelessness could, quote, spark a full-scale race war following the bloody Watts riots in Los Angeles. During the call, Johnson emphasized the need to fight poverty and the political challenges he faced trying to do it.
We've got to have some of these housing programs, and we've got to get rid of these ghettos, and we've got to get these children out from where the rats eat on them at night, and we've got to get them some jobs.
LBJ had hoped his recordings would not be made public for 50 years, but once their existence became known, the library began releasing them, parceling them out over a 15-year period. Mark Lawrence has been director of the LBJ Library since January 2020.
In the early 1990s, Mrs. Johnson, who was still very vigorous and very much part of daily life at the LBJ Library, made a decision along with the administration of the library at that time to go ahead and start processing and releasing the LBJ phone recordings. So they wound up being released well ahead of the schedule that LBJ himself had imagined.
Recently, audio diaries made by Lady Bird Johnson have added to what we know about the First Lady's role in LBJ's life and work. The diaries are the source for a new biography and podcast that illuminate her role as a witness to history, including the day in Dallas when John F. Kennedy was killed.
Friday, November 22nd. It all began so beautifully. The streets were lined with people, lots and lots of children all smiling, placards, confetti, people waving from windows. Suddenly, there was a sharp, loud shot.
The tapes also show that Mrs. Johnson played a critical role in the creation of the library. Here's Library Director Mark Lawrence.
She, after all, was the UT alum, and she played, indeed, a really important role in the design, in creating the festivities, of course, around the opening of the library. And then she would go on to be such a central fixture to the library and its programs for many, many years thereafter until she passed away in 2007.
It was Lady Bird Johnson who identified a building whose architectural style she thought would be a match for her husband's vision. She was inspired by Yale University's Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. The Beinecke's architect, Gordon Bunshaft, was hired to design the LBJ Library. And once the University of Texas made clear that it wanted to host the building, the pieces began to fall into place. After LBJ's term ended in 1969, the Johnsons took an increasingly active role.
There are many wonderful pictures of President Johnson and Mrs. Johnson on the grounds looking at the building as it's under construction. And then they had their picture taken with it just about every angle in front of the building.
The library sits in the northeast corner of UT Austin's campus. The land is also home to the LBJ School of Public Affairs, opened a year before the library, and the Briscoe Center for American History. But the library dominates. Lawrence says Johnson wanted something big all along.
I think he wanted, as we've already discussed, to convey grandeur, the importance of the presidency, the importance of his own presidency and his own contributions to American life.
But its first purpose, housing the physical records of the Johnson presidency, was apparent to visitors in 1971. Rows upon rows of red archive boxes, their presidential seals facing forward, were housed on upper floors but visible from the ground level. Mrs. Johnson got the idea to put the archives front and center when she visited Harry Truman's presidential library and found his papers were not prominent.
Some more dramatic use ought to be made of them, those papers. They could still be secure behind glass partitions. Some use could be made of color. There could be some displays highlighting the outstanding achievements of a president's year.
In the past 5 decades, millions of people have passed through the library's permanent museum exhibits. The library has also played host to an array of public programs, speakers, and special events over the years.
But I would say that the LBJ Library was really the first to attach a high priority to this kind of programming, to the goal of being an active voice in public debate going well beyond the period of the presidency itself.
LBJ's outsized personality is part of the museum, too. From his Central Texas boyhood to an almost life-size replica of his Oval Office featuring original furnishings, along with the 3 televisions LBJ used to keep a constant eye on what network news anchors were saying about him. On its 50th anniversary, the LBJ Library remains closed to the public as pandemic precautions continue. Lawrence says the building will reopen gradually beginning this summer. For now, visitors can explore a new website featuring the greatest hits, as Lawrence says, of the Johnson phone recordings, along with documents and photos contextualizing the tapes. I'm Shelley Brisbane for the Texas Standard.
Great story. Can't wait to see all of the changes that have taken place at that museum and presidential library at UT Austin. Well, finally, this week, a conversation with Silver City author Sharman Apt Russell. She's a professor emeritus at Western New Mexico University, and her new book is Within Our Grasp, Childhood Malnutrition and the Revolution Taking Place to End It. I want to start with a statistic that may surprise some people who are watching the show today. Your book notes that nearly 1 in 4 children worldwide are stunted physically and mentally due to lack of food or nutrients. Give us a sense of this problem and why it's so common.
Okay, thank you. Well, when we look at images on the media of famine, of hungry children, we see those skeletal children, their eyes too bright, those protruding ribs. We're looking at severe childhood malnutrition, and it's called wasting. And we are looking at a body that's cannibalizing itself, that's using every bit of its fat reserves, its muscles, its vitamins, struggling to survive. And without help, that child will die. And we actually think about 7% of children in the world are wasted or some form on the continuum of that. They're too thin for their height, for their age. But a much more prevalent form of childhood malnutrition, as you say, nearly 1/4 of our children in the world are a form of malnutrition we call stunting. And stunting can start in the womb, and it usually happens in the first years of life. And it is also a faltering of growth because of a lack of food and nutrients. So most of us, most humans, follow the same growth patterns in the first 5 years of life. Your genetic potential, what makes one person short and one person tall, kicks in later in childhood. And that's why the World Health Organization can actually measure if a child under the age of 5, if his or her growth is faltering, if she's too short for her age.
Go ahead. I know you had more to say.
Right. If you're too short for your age, but what's important to understand is that this is shorthand for this range of physical and mental and emotional problems. If you're stunted, it's not reversible. A stunted 1-year-old becomes a stunted 10-year-old, becomes a stunted adult. And as a child, you might have cognitive problems. You'll do less well in school. You might have emotional problems. You might get sick more often because you'll have immune problems. So not getting those nutrients, vitamins and minerals and calories too, just food, in that time of life when your brain and your body is developing so quickly, that will affect you your entire life. As an adult, you'll be at greater risk for so many different diseases.
Good reason for us to start with this topic, and as well, the fact that you may not realize that a child is malnourished because they may have a normal weight or even perhaps be above a normal weight, but they aren't getting the right nutrients, the right types of food, so they're malnourished. Give us an idea of some of the differences and similarities between childhood malnutrition in a wealthy country like America, as opposed to a poor country like Malawi in Africa, where much of your book takes place.
Yeah, right. Well, there are some similarities. You know, it's a little surprising that we would have any kind of vitamin mineral deficiency, but actually the CDC estimates that 15% of pregnant women in America have an iron deficiency, and 15% of toddlers in America have an iron deficiency. And that's really important because iron is so connected to neurological development. So we do have some of that. We have food insecurity. There are, especially during the pandemic in New Mexico, they estimated that one out of three children might live in a household that's food insecure. And that's when you just don't know when your next meal will be. You know, so it's an emotional as well as a physical, sense of harm. The harm is being done. But in America, the most prevalent form of childhood malnutrition we have is overweight, being obese or overweight under the age of five. And that will, of course, cause all kinds of problems later on as an adult. But this isn't really just an American problem. The majority of children who are overweight actually live in Africa and live in parts of Asia.
Interesting. Along with this very difficult challenge for the nation, for the entire world, we have some hope. The subtitle of your book gives us hope: Childhood Malnutrition Worldwide and the Revolution Taking Place to End It. Let's talk about the revolution that you're referring to here.
Yes, yes. You know, I've talked about those searing images on TV about wasted children. I've talked about the lack of this diminishment that a child would have being stunted. The numbers become huge. There are things we can't really absorb: 150 million stunted children, 50 million wasted children. I would never be able to write about this if there wasn't hope. I wouldn't be able to spend time with this subject if there wasn't not only hope, but there's lots of inspiration. I've met so many people working to end this problem in the world. And there's a certain wonder too, because when you explore dysfunction, malnourishment, you have to learn about function. You have to learn about kind of the miracle of the body, of how we turn, food and nutrients into who we are. So the hope is, the revolution is how much better we understand how to treat childhood malnutrition, how much better we understand the role of vitamins and minerals in the body. We used to actually, in the late 90s, diagnose a child with severe malnutrition, put them in a hospital, give them the best care, and half of them would die. We were feeding them the wrong kinds of food, we were feeding them too much food, and we were exposing them to disease. So since then, we've come up with something called ready-to-use therapeutic food. It's kind of a food medicine. It is absolutely what the child needs in terms of vitamins and minerals and calories. It's in this foil packet that doesn't need refrigeration, it doesn't need water. And because of that, you can send it home. We send these very sick children home to be cared for by their mothers and fathers at home, and almost all of them survive. So that was a breakthrough. That was a revolution. And as we learned about that, as we learned how to treat these sick children and really what was happening in our bodies, we learned the importance of women, that if we didn't empower women, we weren't going to deal with this problem. We learned about the importance of sanitation. We learned about the connection of disease and childhood malnutrition. We became, much more smart about sustainable agriculture, about economics. So we have this holistic approach now. We really do know what to do. We don't have to research this too much more.
Yeah.
We just have to do it.
Sharman Apt Russell of Silver City. She's a professor emeritus at Western New Mexico University and the author of the new book, Within Our Grasp: Childhood Malnutrition and the Revolution Taking Place to End It. That's KRWG News this week, broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.